This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A very thin layer between the sea surface and the atmosphere may be a major factor in how hot we get and how fast. Since the ocean absorbs at least a quarter of all our greenhouse gas emissions, it's a big deal how the sea surface microlayer operates now and in the future. We have news based on hard measurements from a team of scientists in Great Britain. The lead author joins us to explain. Dr. Ryan Pereira is a research fellow at the Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. From low river air in the Amazon to the weird spot where the ocean and atmosphere mix, Ryan peers into microbiology and geochemistry of places that are barely visible to the human eye. His latest paper was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on May 28, 2018. From Edinburgh, Ryan Pereira, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks very much.
Well, look, it's good to talk with you. And at first glance, I have to admit, the whole subject of your paper seemed a little fuzzy to me. And then I realized that's because you're exploring places that are really unknown to most of us. For the layperson, what is the sea surface microlayer, or SML?
Sure. So the sea surface microlayer is the skin of any water surface. So in this case, we're talking about the ocean. If you wanted to give an exact depth, it's something around 400 microns in thickness. A way that I often explain it to, as you say, lay people or the neighbor next door, is that it's like the meniscus on your drink or some kind of cocktail. So it's a very, very thin layer.
A meniscus, did you say?
A meniscus, absolutely.
I don't know that word. What's that?
So if you have a glass of water and you hold it up to the light and you look through the glass, you'll see that the water surface itself has got two lines to it, okay, the top and the bottom, and that is the water layer, and that's known as a meniscus.
Great. Okay, now, this surface microlayer must be heaved up and down by waves and tides or drawn around by currents and winds. Does the microlayer maintain itself as constant and everywhere in the ocean?
Okay, so the surface microlayer is physically and chemically distinct from its underlying waters. That's something else that I should have said. And so it does vary in space and time as a function of turbulence. So, for example, wind and waves. So either that's airside turbulence or waterside turbulence. And then as a function of supply of various substances from the underlying water to the surface as they rise up.
According to your studies, key particles within the sea surface microlayer can reduce the amount of carbon the ocean can absorb, and that could increase the amount of carbon dioxide left in the atmosphere and so warm the planet. But to understand, we have to talk about something called surfactants. I thought I knew what they were, but I didn't know what they are in the ocean. What is a surfactant?
Well, a surfactant is a shortened word for surface active substances. What are surface active substances? Well, they are something that is lipophilic and hydrophilic, so water and fat loving, okay? And these molecules, they can stand end on end and form surface slicks in the ocean, but they can also dampen waves on the ocean. And they can be man-made or they can be naturally produced. So naturally produced surfactants could be things such as exudates from phytoplankton within the ocean. You can actually even produce them off the skin of your hands, or they can be produced by man. So soaps, for example, are a natural surfactant, an anthropogenic surfactant that are used obviously in day-to-day, so things like detergents and so on.
Yes, in detergents. I think that's where I first heard about surfactants. They're in advertising or on the packages of detergents. But these ones that we're talking about, though, come from phytoplankton, but they're not phytoplankton. They come from it. What's that about?
Okay, so a lot of that work still needs to be determined. I mean, there's a lot of literature about biologically produced surfactants and where they can come from. I think ultimately we are attributing the surfactants that we have observed to biological surfactants because of the where we have found them in the ocean themselves. So the influence of man-made surfactants is highly unlikely. And we would, we talk about primary producers here in phytoplankton. So really we talk about algal substances or algal communities, shall we say.
And why do surfactants matter when it comes to the ocean as a carbon sink?
So with respect to the gas exchanges that we've been discussing here, when surfactants go to the surface ocean, they can either act as a physical barrier, thereby reducing the rate of exchange or the speed at which gases can travel across that surface microlayer or the ocean film that we discussed earlier, or they can actually dampen capillary waves. So these are waves that are on the ocean surface, and they actually reduce the surface area that allows for gas exchanges. So therefore, you reduce the amount of gas that can travel over one particular area.
And before your new study, Ryan, what did climate scientists assume about the ocean's capacity to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere?
What do you mean by that question?
Well, your study has changed something about the way climate scientists make assumptions about the ocean's ability to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, true?
Sure. So you can't measure gas transfer easily in the fields, because obviously we talked about turbulence, waves, it varies in space and time. And so we typically have to parameterize or the rate of exchange for a given location. And we do that using wind speed typically, okay? And wind speed is something that is fairly well modeled or measured across the globe for various locations. However, there is an uncertainty in the gas transfer velocities, or the speed at which gas can transfer from the atmosphere to the ocean or vice versa, and wind speed, okay? And this scatter creates an uncertainty, okay? And so what we have tried to ascertain is, what is this uncertainty and why does this uncertainty exist? And to do that, we've looked at other secondary factors. This could include bubble formation, but we have specifically looked at surfactants and the surface microlayer.
Right, and you did some earlier work on the wind effect in 2017. You co-authored a paper there. And what did you find that was a contribution to science in that paper?
Okay, so that was actually a prelude to this work here in the Atlantic Ocean, in that we were assessing the role of surfactants in the microlayer in coastal systems. And so we did a fairly similar approach, where we were taking surfactant measurements from the surface water and the underlying water, and also gas exchange measurements. But we were doing them in space and time. So we had a transect that went out from the northeast of the UK, 20 kilometers out into the North Sea, so that we had a salinity gradient. And we then repeated that transect through time to look at seasonal effects, so winter and summer. Okay, and what we found was that there was a summer-winter difference, where we were seeing greater suppressions in the summer, potentially associated with autochthonous or surfactants that are produced within the ocean itself. And then in the winter, we found that the greatest suppressions were near the coast, and that was related to supply of surfactants potentially coming from rivers.
Well, let's get to how you know what you know. You took an important ocean cruise in 2014. Tell us about the ship and the mission.
Okay, so the ship was the James Clark Ross, the research vessel James Clark Ross, which is part of the British Antarctic Survey's fleet that they use to support the British Antarctic Survey effort down in Antarctica. And I was fortunate enough to join the Atlantic Meridional Transect, which is a program that runs every year and has run for about 27 years, I think, now, where the ship during the transport or the voyage down to Antarctica is made available for science, where you can stop twice a day, throw a cast or what we call a CTD, a conductivity, temperature, and depth probe that allows us to collect samples. And we did that twice a day, so during midday and in midnight, and we would collect samples, so that we would then establish a transect of various geochemical or biological parameters going from the UK down to the Falkland Islands.
And climate scientists have used formulas, from what I understand, largely dependent on measurements of chlorophyll taken by satellites in space, but your team on this trip used some sort of tank to take direct measurements from the Atlantic, from the UK all the way to the Falkland Islands. What is that gas exchange tank?
Well, there are a couple of elements to this. So first of all, you mentioned about remote measurements and then point measurements. And I think it's very important to remember that remotely sensed technology such as chlorophyll A, which is done via satellites, is a great way of spatially upscaling and giving a broad scale picture, but that needs to be calibrated to point scale measurements. And the first point is that the surfactant measurements that we were making as a direct measurement on the voyage as well didn't correlate to any of those remotely sensed measurements that we expected would happen. And so this is why we talked about this invisible layer that's infecting the gas exchanges. With regard to your second point, which was about the gas exchange tank itself, what is it? Well, I affectionately call it my fish tank. It's about that sort of size. It's 180 liters, and we would fill it half full, so about 90 liters of water, and then we would add a tracer gas that we would use for measuring the gas transfer velocities, or estimating the gas transfer velocities by measuring the concentration of gas in the water and in the atmosphere over a period of time within this tank. So essentially what we are looking or doing is measuring gas in the water and in the atmosphere over a period of about 3 hours to see how they exchange. And because it's supercharged, the gas concentration is supercharged in the water, what we should see is gas concentrations going down in the water over time, but increasing in the atmosphere or the headspace over time. And we're then able to estimate a flux estimate for that.
Did this new paper come from measurements taken on that 2014 voyage? And if so, why did it take 4 more years to publish it?
Do you know, you're not the first person to ask me that question. The data did indeed come from the 2014 mission. I think, first of all, it's important to note that cruise scheduling and cruise effort takes an awful long time. So, of course, we didn't actually get our equipment back until 2015. So although the voyage happened in September and October 2014, we didn't get all of the equipment, the data back till 2015. Now, of course, we made the tank measurements and looked at the data very, very quickly within 2015 itself. But it's not just about making measurements. It's about establishing a framework to actually understand and contextualize your data. So an awful lot of the work that we did was actually to be able to upscale and really interpret our data for the entire Atlantic Ocean, not just for September and October when we went out on the cruise, but actually to think about the entirety of 2014. So is there a way that we can upscale our point scale measurements for space and time? And that's really what took the extra amount of time, so from 2015 to 18.
Radio EcoShock. If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Ryan Pereira, a researcher from Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh. We're talking in a general way about whether the ocean can continue to absorb our carbon dioxide pollution or the rate that it does. And we talked earlier, Ryan, about the relationship of wind and carbon uptake. Do we have a universal formula that works in every ocean?
Okay, so there are parameterizations that exist for a given wind speed. And you remember earlier that I mentioned that for various wind speeds, we can estimate the gas transfer velocity. And those parameterizations are applied. But the biological aspect that we have brought in hasn't yet been considered. And so further work really needs to go to address how surfactants vary in spaces and time so that we can then start to apply that in different ocean basins, for example, or coastal systems.
Your study looks at the main driver of global warming, carbon dioxide, but does this new look at carbon uptake by the ocean tell us more about methane as well?
It could do. So the reason that we focused on CO2 is that basically we are restricted by the global database. So when we actually measure gas transfer velocities in our gas exchange tank, we actually use methane as our tracer gas. And then we convert using various scaling factors known as a Schmidt number, the scale for various gases based on solubility and diffusivity. And so that's how we were able to determine a gas exchange coefficient for the CO2. Now, the reason that our paper focused on CO2 is literally the database of PCO2 measurements in the ocean and then, of course, the atmosphere, and we're able to scale for that again over the period of 2014, which was when our study was done, and for the different zones within the Atlantic Ocean that we're focusing on. It would entirely be possible to look at methane for exactly the, in exactly the same way, but we don't have the scale of measurements for methane across the Atlantic Ocean to do that.
Why is the surfactant suppression effect greater in the northern hemisphere than in the southern Atlantic? And does it matter that most of the carbon dioxide that could be transferred to the ocean is mainly coming from the northern hemisphere as well?
That's a really good question. Why is that the case? Well, okay, we already know that it's due to the amount of surfactants that are present, and that's most likely as a function of primary productivity. I think we can also say that there may be some forcing there as a result of sea surface temperatures as well, and that's where these warmer waters are. I think with respect to moving forward, I think it is difficult to assess because we just don't really have a wide understanding of the variability of surfactants in the ocean and all of their sources.
Right. And you also talk about hotspots of CO2 exchange in the Atlantic Ocean. Do these matter sort of on a global scale?
Yes. I mean, hotspots of gas exchange, of course, are important because it's not uniform across the Atlantic Ocean. I think these hotspots really are just the first eye-opener as where we perhaps need to focus some of our effort on where we should go back to take further gas exchange measurements and also surfactant measurements to further constrain our work. You know, these hotspots that we've identified are estimates, and I think it would be a first look, and I think we really now need to go to where these hotspots are and do, you know, a primary calibration to make sure that what our estimates are saying are actually true.
We've had experts on phytoplankton on Radio EcoShock, including Sergei Petrovsky, but no one seems sure whether plankton will increase or decrease as the globe warms. What does your study assume, and could that be a further factor in how surfactants in the sea affect the future climate?
So our work showed that with increasing sea surface temperatures, we saw increased surfactants. And so there is a natural feedback loop in the cycle and the carbon cycle here. I think, you know, as you've already indicated, there are experts in phytoplankton and phytoplankton production, and I am certainly not one of those experts, but I think I would predict, or we would hypothesize, that with the increasing temperatures that we would observe, we would expect to see more surfactants as a result of increasing phytoplankton presence or productivity. But of course, I would also expect that there would be some kind of threshold or tipping point where that relationship would no longer hold true as a function of temperature. But when, what threshold value that actually is, that's unknown at present.
So your study, Ryan Pereira, was based on hard data from the Atlantic Ocean. Does it apply equally well to the larger Pacific, or do we have to ship you off to some Pacific islands?
I think you need to ship me off to some Pacific islands, particularly on a good weather day, if that's all right. One with nice beaches are also fully appreciated. No, I mean, in all seriousness, we focused on the Atlantic Ocean because that's where we have primary data from. And, you know, holding my hands up here as a scientist, we had 13 data points that we upscaled from. Of course, we need, and I hate to use the traditional scientific analogy or scientist analogy, but we do really need more data to, you know, look at the seasonal cycle, you know, capturing primary data from, say, the months of January, February, and October, November, where we've seen peak hotspots of activity. And then really we also need to think about how different oceans also behave differently and the circulation patterns associated with that. So, you know, measurements do need to be made in the Pacific Ocean or the Indian Ocean, which really do function completely differently to the Atlantic.
And the abstract for your new paper begins, quote, ocean CO2 uptake accounts for 20% to 40% of the post-industrial sink for anthropogenic CO2. 20 to 40% is a really big range. It makes a very big difference whether 40% of industrial emissions are being absorbed by the ocean or just 20%. Why hasn't this been nailed down much closer than that so far?
Very good question. So that particular statement comes from a reference, and I'm trying to think which reference that comes from at the moment, and I can't answer your question there.
Cunliffe?
Yes, it may well be. Why is the range so high? Very good question. I think, first of all, it's because there's such a variability in the various sinks, and that it also changes in, I keep on saying it, but in space and time. So we already know that the ocean absorbs CO2 at different periods of time because of turbulent settings or turbulence variance, shall we say.
And in part, your paper is kind of a warning to other climate modelers about a weakness of big picture data versus what you actually found taking samples from a ship. What do modelers need to know and to change?
Oh, gosh, what do modelers need to know and change? That's a difficult question. I mean, I am not a modeler. I try to further understand key processes, or at least what I consider to be key processes, with empirical data. I think what the general message of this paper is that we need to make sure that we fully understand not just primary variables, but where we see uncertainty, that we can really look at this, you know, key secondary or tertiary variables that are causing, you know, factors of uncertainty that are likely to propagate out in models when we start to consider upscaling or modeling future scenarios.
And although this is a study of the Atlantic Ocean, Ryan, your paper in Nature Geoscience does consider, quote, global implications of surfactant suppression effect. So do you have any suggestions on what this new study may add to our predictions about the future climate?
Well, gosh, that's, again, a big question. I think what we've demonstrated is that we know that there are hotspots of CO2 exchange, and we need to better constrain where those hotspots are and also when do they exist, because we know that they can move over time, is particularly seasonally. And also what we don't know is how that changes interannually. You know, are different years going to operate differently? So this data is only from 2014, and we really don't know what it was like in 2015, 16, 17, or even this year. Sorry, repeat your question.
Well, I'm just asking about what this means for the future climate, because we found here something that can suppress the ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide, and we need that function very badly. And your paper seems to narrow down how that all operates.
See, this is a really difficult question. I mean, yes, we know that the surfactant suppression effect could reduce or does reduce the Atlantic Ocean store by 9%. I think the challenge is that this process has already been happening, but if we're trying to model in the future, then we need, this is actually a really tricky question, like, you know, what is the global implication of our work, right? I mean, that's
exactly
where you're heading with this. How do we want to take this forward? I think what we're suggesting here is that we know that because of this relationship between sea surface temperatures and the presence of surfactants, that a warmer climate, which would be part of this positive feedback, would lead to further suppression. But of course, that will also have a threshold in itself, because increasing CO2 in the atmosphere would create an increased concentrational gradient between the atmosphere and the ocean. But we really haven't been able to constrain those rates, and we really aren't able to predict that in an accurate way, or at least not to my knowledge.
So, Ryan, you've studied optically invisible dissolved organic matter in the Amazon, and now bits that we think come from plankton and a hair-thin layer of the ocean. It must be hard to discuss your work at Social Functions. How and why did you get involved in this line of research?
We observed a relationship that didn't make any sense. I think that's how we got into this idea of invisible organic matter. Tea parties, and I'll come back to that in a second, how I explain my research is that if we take a cup of tea, and let's imagine it's in a glass so that we can see it, and you take your hot water and you add your tea bag, you have got colored dissolved organic matter in there, okay? And you can see it because it's brown in color. If I then add sugar to that tea, it dissolves, okay, but you can't see it because it's invisible, right? But if you started to taste your tea, you would know that it's been sweetened, okay? And that's what we call invisible dissolved organic matter in this case, or invisible carbon. And that's how I explain it to say, my parents or to those that aren't scientists. And the reason that we became interested in this invisible organic carbon was that when we were in the Amazon looking at these organics, we found that techniques that we were looking to quantify carbon during rain events weren't working. They weren't correlating to the total organic carbon that we were measuring via a more robust laboratory method. And so we started to ask the question, well, why is that relationship falling apart? And essentially we found that some types of organic carbon were actually UV optically invisible to various techniques that we use to measure total organic carbon. So this was in the Amazon using various probes, and it's been also upscaled in satellites. So in this particular context, when we come back to the story in the Atlantic, what we found was that the colored dissolved organic matter measurements made from satellites at the same time were not, or the abundance of this measurement wasn't relating to the abundance of surfactants that we were measuring, which is giving us some kind of indication that these surfactants are actually optically invisible to the satellite measurements.
Fair enough. And as we wrap up here, Ryan, what are you working on now, and what are the tasks ahead as you see them?
What are we working on now? I think there's a couple of parts. One is that we really want to try and understand, building on the theme earlier, is, you know, how do surfactants relate to the overall carbon pool? So how are they being sourced? When are they being sourced? And when are they being cycled up to the surface microlayer? And how does that vary in space and time? We talked about other ocean settings, but also coastal settings. And what is the varying effect on gas suppression? We already have done some preliminary work that demonstrates that different types of organic substances or surfactants will actually vary the gas exchange. So the composition type seems to be important for the amount of gas exchange. And so this is the next step for us, looking at the composition of organics, how they change, and the variable rate of gas exchange.
The new paper we've been talking about is titled Reduced Air-Sea CO2 Exchange in the Atlantic Ocean Due to Biological Surfactants. It was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on May 28th. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Ryan Pereira, from Harriet Watt University in Scotland. I'll put notes and links to all this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Ryan, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I've learned quite a bit from you today.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Why are you here?
I'm here because climate change is probably the most important issue of our time, and if we don't do something about it in the next 10 years, it might be too late. And so it's about, Canadians overwhelmingly want our federal and provincial governments to take action on global warming. And unfortunately, in most cases, they're dragging their heels. And so today's it's a celebration, but it's also a call to action. And telling our federal government to be a leader on climate change instead of a laggard. It's embarrassing when other countries are miles ahead of us. And Canada is just dragging its heels. And so today's saying, you know what? Let's do something, and let's do it in the right way. Let's reclaim the green mantle that Canada used to have at one time.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now that climate change has melted the Arctic sea ice, for part of the year at least, Russia is scrambling to grab any new oil, gas, or coal that suddenly becomes available along their northern shore. That way, just so you understand, climate change helps humans make climate change worse. But that is not the bottom of crazy. You haven't heard outright madness until you hear this story from Jan Haverkamp. Jan is a trained scientist and a specialist in nuclear energy and radiation. He works for Greenpeace in Central Europe. Jan co-founded the Brussels-based NGO Nuclear Transparency Watch. Haverkamp teaches environmental communication at Masaryk University in the Czech Republic. For years, Jan lived and worked from Prague, but now he's back in the Netherlands. From Amsterdam, Jan Haverkamp, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jan, if we were looking at the big barge called the Academic Lomonosov, what would we see?
You see a 144-meter-long brown-black block with a central block on top of it. 144 meters is quite long. I've seen it in the Baltic Sea with on the background a few container ships. Then it's not that big. It's 30 meters wide. It's about 28 meters high. In the central part, this extra block on top, there is the place where two icebreaker reactors are situated. It didn't look very pleasant. It looks quite ugly, but the artist's impressions are a lot better. It's supposed that it's still going to be painted over. The artist's impressions have made it very beautifully white and blue. So far, it looks really also not only ugly from the inside, but also ugly from the outside.
And before we dig deeper into this story, Jan, what makes this nuclear barge stand out among all the other crazy news these days?
This is the first purpose-built nuclear power station that is situated on a barge. We've had one earlier, which was the U.S. Sturgis, an old Liberty ship from the Second World War, which was equipped with a submarine reactor and provided power for the Panama Canal Zone for 7 years until they rejected it from there because it was running relatively often into trouble. That one has only been decommissioned or is in decommissioning at the moment, and the reactor was only removed last year. You can already see a little bit how complex it is to deal with something like a floating nuclear power station. The operation in the Panama Canal Zone was in the 1960s, and decommissioning was only now.
The Russians and the Soviet government before them put nuclear reactors in everything from icebreakers to submarines. What is their safety record?
That is not so good. We've had accidents during construction, during maintenance. We've had accidents on full sea. And those include also several where there have been meltdowns, so fuel meltdowns, during a testing problem in Nizhny Novgorod, what is now Nizhny Novgorod and was still Gorky in the Soviet times. 29 people died. We've had several dozens of severe incidents, and several of these reactors are also still on the bottom of the sea because of the accidents that the submarines that were carrying them were submitted to.
Why did people in St. Petersburg protest operations building that barge, Academic Lomonosov?
Well, that was already last year. The initial start of the construction was not in St. Petersburg, but because of all kinds of internal trouble between different involved oligarchs, construction was moved to the Baltic shipyards in St. Petersburg. And that shipyard is situated very centrally. It is on 2.5 kilometers from the St. Isaac Cathedral, about 3 kilometers, 3 and a bit from the Hermitage. So it's bang in the center of St. Petersburg. And the idea was originally that when the construction was finalized, that the fuel would be loaded in the Baltic shipyard and that the barge would be tested there. Now, the testing phase is one of the more risky parts of the lifetime of a reactor. And people in St. Petersburg were not really very happy with it. There was a petition which drew 12,000 signatures, which for any petition in Russia which is critical on something that is done by the authorities is an enormous amount. And questions were asked in the Environmental Committee of the Legislative Council of the city, which then basically asked the authorities to not to load and test the reactor in the city, in the midst of a city with 5 million inhabitants. There was also a lot of pressure on this from the countries along the Baltic Sea, not as much because of the testing in St. Petersburg, but also at the moment that the reactors are tested, they're irradiated, which means that the radioactive contact is a lot higher than when there's no fuel on board. And they were very much afraid that when it would be transported, towed, because it does not have its own propulsion, so it would be towed through the Baltic Sea and along the Norwegian coast, in case of heavy storm and the thing running on the rocks, it might really be also an radiation risk for their shore. So they put up quite a lot of diplomatic pressure on Russia as well. And the result was that last year, Rosatom decided not to load and not to test it in St. Petersburg, but tow it empty to Murmansk. And that is where it has now arrived 2 weeks ago, and where it is to be loaded in the coming months and then tested.
And can you just briefly tell us, our listeners, where Murmansk is?
Well, St. Petersburg, as you may know, is on the Baltic Sea coast. So you have it's very near Finland and Estonia in the northern part of the Baltic Sea. Murmansk is in the northwest of Russia. It is not so far from where Norway touches Russia and where Finland touches Russia.
So it's up in the Arctic Sea, really?
It is already in the Arctic Sea, yes.
Okay. Now, you have said previously that the design of this barge as a floating platform for reactors is not safe. Could you tell us why?
Well, it is. First of all, if you build a nuclear power plant on a floating structure, you have to be quite weight conscious. That means that a lot of the very heavy end-of-pipe solutions that we put on nuclear power stations to prevent at any time radioactivity coming out, a lot of those kind of very heavy measures cannot be taken on a barge. On top of that, the space is very limited, and that means also that you are cutting corners with the type of safety measures that you can implement. That means that the risk of something going wrong is just higher than when we compare that with a land-based nuclear power station of the last generation. That is one part. The other part is it's on a barge. And when that barge comes loose, it could either be thrown on the rocks in a storm, or during transport, it could also run onto ice. And the hull could be torn open, like for instance happened with the unsinkable Titanic. That also adds to the extra risk. There are two issues that add to extra risk, and for that reason, environmental organizations like Greenpeace, but also like Bellona and others, are very critical about the introduction of floating reactors, be it on barges or in submarines or on icebreakers, into a pretty hostile environment as the Arctic.
Is there a significant storm risk for the waters where this barge is intended to go, and where is it intended to go?
Well, it is intended to go to Pevek, and Pevek is in Chukotka, which is the furthest northeastern province of Russia, the one that is also nearest to Alaska. Pevek itself is still about 1,000 kilometers further to the west, so it's not that near to Alaska. From Murmansk to Pevek, the voyage is almost 5,000 kilometers, or about 3,500 miles. That's a very long stretch, and it's an area that can see very heavy weather. That includes heavy storms, but it also includes unpredictable ice activity there. So icebergs or other floating ice in the region.
From what I can see, Jan, all the Russian nuclear reactors and new atomic constructions are run by a state-owned company called an English Rosenergoatom, or sometimes Rosatom. Is that correct?
Well, the Rosatom group is, let's say, the center of this enormous conglomerate, which used to be the state ministry for nuclear energy in the Soviet times. After Soviet times, it was made into a separate corporate entity called Rosatom, and that has several hundreds of sub-units and companies under it. Yes, it's Rosatom that is responsible not only for all the civil nuclear power in Russia, but also for all the military nuclear power in Russia. They also build and oversee, for instance, the nuclear weapon part of the Russian nuclear system.
The Russian state-owned company is promoting this barge project with quotes from an Australian convert to nuclear power, Dr. Ben Hurd. Ben is the executive director of the NGO Bright New World. The Russian nuclear company, Rosatom, quotes been heard in their propaganda, I would call it, but in their promotion for this project, and they have been saying this: it's fair to point out that the Arctic is a vulnerable ecosystem, but its greatest vulnerability is to climate change. This power plant is going to replace an existing coal-fired power station and provide zero carbon electricity generation for 50,000 people. There is literally no prospect of that energy coming from renewable energy sources in that location. Jan Haverkamp, what is your response?
Well, first of all, I mean, Pevek itself at the moment has 5,000 inhabitants, and the coal power station that Ben is referring to is the thermal or the heat, the generation plant that provides Pevek also with heat. That's a minor plant. What it also has to provide electricity for is some of the remaining mining activity in that area, and that includes, amongst others, also coal mining. So that is one part of the equation. It's not only going to replace an old coal power plant, it's also going to enable more coal mining, which means also more coal burning. But I think that is all slightly besides the point when Ben is claiming that it's impossible or that it's not likely that renewable energy will be introduced there. Then that is a conscious political choice. Rosatom is pretty new. He's also working on renewable energy, but is still pretty new in it. They're now making their first experiences with wind energy together with a Dutch company called Lagerwey. But the potential for renewable energy in the area is enormous. And a small town like Pevek and the surroundings could easily be powered with a combination of wind power and, for instance, sustainably harvested biomass from the surroundings. That is, as such, not a problem. What is for us the larger concern is that this is going to be the first of a whole series of floating nuclear power stations, and that has to power the further development of the entire north, including Pevek. And that development is development for more oil, gas, and coal extraction. So for me, this is a bit of a double whammy. It is introducing nuclear risk in an area where nuclear risk is a larger problem than, for instance, in more moderate places like Fukushima or Belgium or in the United States. That is the first point. The second point is it is meant to increase extraction of fossil fuels. So for me, that is clear enough that Ben is used here for propaganda.
And it worries me that a supposed green voice in Australia is being used by Russian state propaganda for their nuclear adventures.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the world's largest environment program on nonprofit radio. Our guest is nuclear campaigner and scientist Jan Haverkamp. We're talking about a dangerous new development by Russia, floating barges with nuclear reactors off to the Arctic. Many scientists on Radio EcoShock have explained why the Arctic is uniquely vulnerable to pollution. What happens when this atomic barge has a major nuclear accident or just sinks in a storm? And do the Russians explain any plan that they have for that?
There are no real plans for emergency response in these kind of cases. We've seen it in the past with the Kursk nuclear submarine. The attempts to have the reactors from that, and also, of course, the people who were on board, but the reactors from that salvaged, have cost several billions of dollars, so it's not very easy to do something when something goes wrong. But I think your listeners will be aware of the fact that with any nuclear power stations, we have severe problems with emergency response and preparedness. The more challenging the environment is, the more challenging also post-accident reactions are. Yeah, in this case, Rosatom is counting very much is there are now not very many people living there. So the personal damage may be, because of that, lower. Of course, these reactors are smaller, and you do have to acknowledge that it's not as big as the reactors that went wrong in Fukushima or in Chernobyl. But still, for the people involved, that still will be a very big catastrophe in their lives.
What are the issues with refueling these reactors, and what happens to the highly radioactive spent fuel?
The reactors have a fueling cycle of about 2.5 years. The Lomonosov will be towed to Pevek, will stay there for 12 years. So that means that we will have about 4 or 5 fuel cycles there. That means that it has all its fuel, its fresh fuel on board. And at the moment that a cycle needs to be changed, there will be fuel change from the reactor. The spent fuel will be remaining on board, will be stored on board.
On Radio EcoShock, Dr. Helen Caldicott told us that all nuclear reactors create plutonium, and not just a little plutonium. Would this barge, Academic Lomonosov, have plutonium and other super radioactive fission products on it as well?
Well, the spent nuclear fuel from these reactors is like spent nuclear fuel from any boiling water reactor, so it indeed contains plutonium and other actinides. That spent nuclear fuel is extremely radioactive, and one of the design problems that we already know that the Lomonosov has is that after about 4 or 5 fuel changes, the radioactivity level from the storage of the spent fuel is so high that it will limit the amount of time that the crew can spend on board. They are planning to change that in new designs, but this design has that just as a problem, and it's one of the reasons that already after 12 years it will need to go back to Murmansk for unloading that spent fuel and for maintenance.
Britain used to dump radioactive barrels straight into the ocean until Greenpeace protests helped stop that. There are a number of reactors, I think it's 9, now sitting at the bottom of the sea, including the American submarine USS Scorpion. And the Japanese are now threatening to dump atomic pollution from blown reactors at Fukushima. Here's my question to you, Jan, as an environmental scientist. Have there been studies on how nuclear particles move around in the ocean?
Well, there are quite a few older studies to the spread of, well, several things. I mean, it's first of all the spread of the fallout of nuclear weapons, how that has been spreading through the oceans. We also have seen assessments of what the dumping of radioactive waste by the UK, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, and Belgium, and Germany in the Atlantic, just south of the United Kingdom, has resulted in. Fission products from that, so isotopes from that dumping, and that was low and mid-level radioactive waste, has been found on both poles, so as we found both in the Arctic as also in the Antarctic, which means that it spreads out very far. That is an advantage. It means dilution. But the other side is, and that we've also seen, especially around these dumping areas, is that part of the waste is also bioaccumulating in the direct surroundings, which means that we have seen there catch of fish, which has been accumulating radioactive particles, isotopes, especially those that are fatty soluble. We know from around Fukushima that the pattern which fish is polluted and not is quite at random, and fishery there still is quite strictly monitored now 6 years after, because every now and then there is fish found which is over limits.
You know that Russia hopes to market these floating reactors to other countries. Who do they hope to sell to?
At the moment, they themselves claim that 15 countries have shown interest. I know for sure that some of that initial shown interest or claimed interest was not really there, like for instance Cabo Verde, the Cape Verde Islands in the Atlantic. They've had one visit once from Rosatom, which was then flagged and promoted as interest in this, but everybody there said, well, this is a crazy idea, we don't want it. But in the countries that are currently under discussion, we have countries like the Philippines, we have Indonesia, and we have Sudan.
Let's say Russia sells a floating reactor to Indonesia. Jan, do the Russians operate and control that reactor, or is there a chance for nuclear proliferation here?
That is difficult to say at this moment, because these talks and ideas are still in a very, very early stage. We know that currently with normal reactors, Rosatom, I mean, you know that the international reactor market is in big trouble because nuclear power has simply become too expensive to market. And financing is the big bottleneck for new programs. And Rosatom has solved it so far by offering countries not only to build reactors, but also to give them either a loan for the full or 90% or 80% of the construction cost, or the option that Rosatom itself will own the reactor and run it and only sell the electricity, like, for instance, in Turkey. I have no idea what in the end the idea will be for floating reactors, but most likely will be that it will be a lease option, so that the country will rent the reactor from Rosatom and pay for that a certain amount of money and then can use the electricity from it. The question is then, who's going to operate it? Will that be Rosatom, or will that indeed be the country that is here in hands? Now, some countries or several countries are looking to nuclear power as a means to obtain nuclear knowledge. And for me, that means that there is a proliferation risk. If I look to a country like Iran, I've got no idea whether they have a bomb. I do know that there are factions within Iran that would like to have a bomb. We even had in Poland, there's a whole discussion going on about Poland building its first nuclear power station. Yes or no, even there we've had voices and factions that said, well, we should get this nuclear knowledge and this nuclear experience so that in 40 or 60 years from now, we would be able to build our own bomb and we would be able to get back Lviv or Vilnius. I mean, there's mad people in every country, and it depends very much on political developments how this knowledge is used. If you spread these kind of floating reactors in their hundreds all around the globe, then that definitely supports proliferation also of nuclear weapon knowledge and probably also of nuclear weapon production.
And there is, sadly, news that both China and Japan are working on floating nuclear reactors. And from my point of view, if we spread floating reactors around the world, we're also creating new targets for terrorism or in a war. Most land-based reactors, as you said, have some protective shell. Are these seagoing reactors hardened against hits by something like a rocket-propelled grenade or even an aircraft flying into them?
You can do a lot with steel, but because you have to be careful with weight, the protection is not as good as we see it on board of a nuclear submarine. It's definitely not as good as you would see it in Generation 3 Plus nuclear reactors, which are protected against also the impact of a moderately large passenger airplane. That is not possible in this form. Plus, we have, of course, the problem that if you are able to create a leak in the reactor, that probably also will mean a leak in the barge itself. If it's sinking at the moment, if reactor material hits seawater, you will get a water explosion, and with that most likely also a far faster emission of radioactive substances from the reactor. The sheer amount also of small reactors that are dreamed of would increase also the chance of a potential terrorist attack at a certain moment. All these things add up, and for me that's a reason to say I don't think that this is the way we need to go, apart from the fact that it's also very costly. The Lomonosov is in construction and operation not cheaper than the very large nuclear power stations that are currently built and that currently are far too expensive to operate on the market. So also there, it doesn't really make sense.
Is it safe for Russian journalists to criticize Russians' reactor schemes?
There is quite a bit of critical noise about this scheme, independent Russian media. The only problem is that the independent Russian media have a very small reach nowadays. You do not talk about television, but you talk about some of the printed media and some radio and a lot of on the social media, on the internet. The reach is very limited, and we know from experience that people criticizing these kind of projects also indeed have to count with intimidation. It's one of the reasons that I'm working on this with our Nordic offices and the Greenpeace Central Europe, that the Russian office is not part of our work there.
If you had to list your three upcoming priority issues, Jan Haverkamp, what would they be?
that goes already beyond only floating nuclear power stations. I think if we look at the development of the energy system, we need to stop being diverted by nuclear power as a technology. Nuclear power will not deliver anything substantial, and what it can deliver, it will deliver far too late for playing a role in the whole climate discussion, because it delivers it for such a price that we can do it a lot cheaper with other technologies nowadays. Nuclear is not part of that solution, but it is part of an existing problem. And what I would like to see is that we turn around the discussion with and within the nuclear industry and within authorities and nuclear authorities away from new production, from new reactors, towards the legacy that 60 years of nuclear power have left us with. We have no way of dealing with the radioactive waste anywhere yet. The projects that are ongoing in Finland and Sweden and France are currently hitting technical obstacles that might well prevent them from ever going into operation. We have no plan B, but we do have 300,000 tons of heavy radioactive, of high-level radioactive waste all around the world. That is, for me, a nightmare. We know already that our generation, your and my generation, will not be able to come with a solution. I know that the generation of my children will not be able to come with a solution. But we do have the responsibility to at least reduce the risks of that as much as we can. And it's not happening at the moment. The third point for me is we need to think a lot more about how we can protect ourselves against potential nuclear emergencies and then also draw conclusions from that. We've seen what the Fukushima catastrophe has done. It made it necessary to evacuate 160,000 people. About 60,000 of them still have not been able and will never be able to return to their houses. That is a scar on the planet. But if I look at other places where we now have running nuclear power stations, also there we cannot really safeguard the people around it if it really goes wrong. And I think that if we are honest about that and if we honestly look at what is in place and what we could expect, we have to draw conclusions for the reactors that are currently in operation, and we have to phase them out as soon as possible. We've got sufficient examples to show that it can be done. Germany is a pointing case, but we also see it now in countries like Sweden, which is going to a nuclear phase out. We see it in Switzerland, Belgium. We have seen it in Taiwan. It is possible to turn that development to one that gives hope to the planet, that tackles climate change in a way that we do not waste money, we do not waste efforts, we're not diverting our attention from what really needs to be done. The technologies are there. It needs political will, and that is where I will be fighting for.
Our guest is nuclear campaigner and scientist Jan Haverkamp. Jan has been warning the world about a dangerous scheme to float nuclear reactors in the seas of the Siberian Arctic. The Russians will use it to exploit still more fossil fuels that endanger our common future. Find links to everything we've talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Jan Haverkamp, thank you for sharing this news on Radio EcoShock.
You're welcome, and I hope that your listeners will help us turn this madness into a bit of a more sensible direction.
From madness to sanity, I'm Alex Smith reporting. By the way, if you tuned in partway or missed a show, you can get all our past programs absolutely free at my website, ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. You don't have to sign up or sign in. Just browse the programs and download to your phone, computer, or whatever you've got. It's possible to get a good education in climate change and the things that shape our future just from those interviews with the world's top experts, authors, and activists. You're welcome. Be sure to tune in next week to Radio EcoShock. We will get the latest update on carbon emissions and the fading hopes of even staying below 2 degrees C this century. I'll be talking with Dr. Pep Canadel, the director of the Global Carbon Project. That is a network of hundreds of scientists, and they have found an unexpected bubble of carbon emissions in the first 3 months of 2018. Don't miss that interview. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and caring about our world.
Radio EcoShock.